You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of December 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, Syria's President Bashar al-Assad thinks that the end could soon be in sight in the country's brutal civil war. My guests, Mary Dujewski and James Rogers, will give us their take on this and the day's other top stories, including Marine Le Pen's call to end free education for foreign children, Boris Johnson's remarks on Saudi Arabia as a puppeteer in Middle East proxy wars, plus Montenegro's last hurdle to access NATO, and how soon citizens from Ukraine and Georgia will be able to travel visa-free to the EU. That's all ahead here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Yes, a warm welcome to Midori House. Alongside me here in Studio One is James Rogers, a senior lecturer in journalism at City University London. Welcome, James. Good to have you with us on the show as ever. We start today's programme in Syria, where pro-government forces are the closest they've ever been to seizing the entire city of Aleppo. Syria's President Bashar al-Assad thinks that the end could soon be in sight in the country's brutal civil war. James, this conflict's gone on for what? More than 5 years. Half a million lives or more lost, 7 million people conservatively displaced by the fighting. Given that backdrop, is there really any meaningful conclusion to think of in sight?
It's difficult to say, to talk about conclusions. I think what is certain, though, if you remember, Tom, until you mentioned it's been going on for 5 years or so, for the first few years of the conflict, the conventional wisdom was that the pro and anti-government forces did not possess sufficient military muscle, either of them, to deliver the knockout blow. Now, since Russia intervened in September of last year, and now here we are 14, 15 months later, and it looks as if a very significant military development has happened, that tends to say that conventional wisdom was correct as far as it went, and that Russia's intervention does seem to have been at least, if not decisive so far, then highly significant. So while, of course, it is too early to talk of a conclusion, it does seem that this is going to be looked back upon as a very significant moment. Question now, of course, is what does Russia want out of this? How long is it going to keep supporting Mr. Assad? Is he and his allies in a position now to go and take large amounts of the rest of the country? What happens to those parts of the country which are still held by Islamic State? And what kind of accommodation might the government reach or not reach with them? And the other question, of course, is if they are able to capture and indeed to hold significant swathes of what had been rebel-held territory, what kind of a position are they going to be to consolidate that? Are they going to face, one imagines, perfectly possible that they will face a long-term low-level insurgency, even if they actually do manage to bring back these areas under control?
And James, it's interesting, you talk about assumptions that were made, perhaps naively, by some in the West, certainly maybe by some in the media, and there's definitely an assumption about Assad, and we saw in that post-Arab Spring environment that there was clearly an assumption made, or an assertion actively by some, that any solution necessarily involved Assad departing. There was no way that there could be any reconciliation, willingly or unwillingly. And that seems to be another assumption that's wrong. Given, as you say, that the risk of a low-level insurgency, and given the fact that, you know, much of the Western leadership will be left with a significant amount of egg on their faces with regards to Assad still being there, what prospect of any kind of meaningful peace? Because presumably he's going to be rather displeased that he didn't receive the backing that other embattled leaders have from time to time received in similar circumstances.
That's right. Now it looks as if there's every prospect that Mr. Assad will outlast in power those leaders, those Western leaders who sought to see him
leave. It's an extraordinary irony.
It is, because it was, I mean, Western policy, such as it was for a number of years, counted on the fact that he would no longer be there, or wouldn't countenance the fact that he might be. And that, in a way, was what Russia gave, what gave Russia its opening, because it saw, I think, probably in the late summer of 2015, a Western policy vacuum. Now, one can agree or not agree with Russian policy, and of course, the West very vehemently disagrees with it, certainly under the current set of leaders. And so it depends what happens now. But certainly we are in a situation where Mr. Assad does look set to outlast them and may eventually be able to consolidate his power. Russia, of course, its ambitions here are key. How long are they willing to commit? And to what extent they've committed militarily. But if you look at, you know, the television coverage coming from there, it is quite clear two things. One, there's going to have to be a massive reconstruction operation. Mm. And two, as after any civil war like this, it takes a very, very long time for those who have been on opposite sides to forgive each other to an extent they can live together and the economy and society can function to a meaningful extent.
And James, one other front, which of course it's impossible to discuss this and not mention, is the civilian cost, and indeed the refugee, the crisis forced by this sheer scale of the movement of people. It's interesting that even as this progress that Assad has announced, we understand rebels are still asking for ceasefires so they can allow civilians that they say remain in the embattled city to leave. The humanitarian situation worsens constantly. Has that been a story that has received enough weight? Again, in the Western media, it's mentioned at times. We see the occasional sob story, but the sheer scale of this crisis is quite extraordinary, isn't it?
Well, I mean, one in defence of the Western media, of course, they haven't had anything like realistic access to the story for the last few years for any number of reasons. Firstly, because they're restricted by the government to doing what they can under the oversight of minders. And secondly, of course, because those parts of the country which are under the control of Islamic State are quite simply too dangerous to report upon. And as many journalists have found out, to their extreme cost. So I think it's inevitable that from the news media, we are getting an incomplete picture of the conflict. But I do think people understand that, you know, the number of people who have been displaced and indeed killed is colossal.
Mm. Mary Dajewski is a columnist for The Independent and Guardian, and she's alongside us here in Studio One. Mary, let me come to you and ask you about the Russian perspective. And James mentioned this briefly a moment or two ago. Clearly, many people disagree with the Russian policy and their pursuit of whatever their gains are in Syria. But we have to concede, I guess, that Putin's played the hand he was dealt fairly skillfully. How do you see the Russian role changing if Assad is indeed right and that this retake of Aleppo is a big step? And I wonder if we look into 2017 and Trump's America, does that add an interesting new front to that dynamic?
Well, I think Trump's America, in a way, is part of a key to what's going on at the moment, because I think it's almost as though President Obama decided that with the election of Trump, policy in Syria, such as it was going to change because there was going to be a degree of disengagement to the extent that the US was engaged at all. Trump was basically not interested and he didn't see it as crucial to American policy. And so, I mean, my view is that almost the moment Trump was elected, the United States decided that they were simply going to back off and they were going to leave it to the Russians. And, you know, it's not actually an adverse argument, even from the humanitarian perspective, because if this brings the war, or at least the war for Aleppo, to an end sooner rather than later, and if, as it's possible to see, the various talks, including emergency talks between Kerry and Lavrov over the weekend, are designed to trying to persuade the Russians to do this as clinically, as fast as it can possibly be done, then I think we may be looking at, yes, there's going to be, you know, everybody knows there's going to be an even more of a humanitarian catastrophe once Aleppo is taken. But I think then, you know, if we're looking into the new year, we're looking into how the Russians conduct themselves as part of the, as it were, the group of victors. And I think that'll be a big test for Russia, because it's, you know, the Americans are used to negotiating these sort of things, and they haven't done it particularly well, but we've watched how they tried and failed in Iraq, they tried and failed in Libya, as did the Europeans. Now, how are the Russians going to try and be, as it were, the allies of the victorious party in Syria? And are they simply going to say, over to you, Bashar al-Assad, do as you want? Or are they going to try and sort of put some legal framework, some sort of negotiations? How are they going to treat the various groups of rebels? It'll be a test for Russia quite as much as anything else.
Mm. And it'll be interesting to see if they even attempt to display, James, one imagines, any sort of diplomatic magnanimity, not perhaps what we would associate with the Putin regime. Just on this point about the election of Trump, though, and this notion that America immediately takes a step back, maybe pursues a more isolationist policy, certainly in military terms, it's interesting, given that, to note that Trump has nevertheless appointed, what, three military men, some rather hawkish, to key cabinet posts. Is there a confusion, perhaps? Well, maybe some people would say it was an inevitable confusion at the heart of whatever the Trump foreign policy agenda might be.
Well, that's the question, isn't it? Whatever the Trump foreign policy might be. I mean, Mr. Trump is known for many things before he was elected. He's not known as anyone either for his expertise or indeed particularly for his knowledge of foreign policy. So it is going to be interesting to see how that develops. From what we know, he has, of course, pursued a much more conciliatory line towards Russia than previous recent U.S. administrations. We constantly hear in any single profile of him, he's talked about as a deal maker, and he's obviously going to bring his experience of commerce to international diplomacy. With what success, it will be interesting to see. But, I mean, to be honest with you, someone who's observed this from the outside of the last few years, anything that stops, you know, as I think Mary was suggesting, you know, the large number of people being killed or at least reduced is, I suppose, to be welcomed. I mean, one can see that a few years ago there was a possibility, had the United States and Russia wanted to work together, they could have ended this conflict much sooner, or at least reduced it if they had chosen to exert their influence in that way. They did not, and we've had a couple of false dawns, and maybe it is going to take a decisive military blow such as this, if it is indeed what it seems to be, to turn the corner and lead towards some sort of settlement or at least reduction of the conflict.
I'd just like to say something about the appointment of military men to the Trump cabinet, because I think that there is a sort of assumption that because there are former generals and people with military experience in an administration, that necessarily means there's going to be a more belligerent policy. I'm not sure that's true, because some of the criticisms of, say, Tony Blair's government and George W. Bush is that leaders who have no hands-on experience of the use of military power are more inclined to use it and are less knowledgeable about it, whereas some of the military circles are actually, they know how it looks, they know how it works, and often, you know, you can look at the British operation in Iraq. Some of the people least enthusiastic about that mission were the military.
Because I guess they're familiar with the constraints of actually having to make the decisions.
Exactly.
An interesting point. Let's bring the focus, though, to Europe now, and perhaps to France, first of all. Earlier today, far-right leader Marine Le Pen called for an end to free education for the children of illegal immigrants. She said, there's no more playtime. Mary, straight back to you with this. I find it rather tricky to imagine a situation anywhere where denying children a free education is anything other than an incredibly bad idea. Am I wrong in this instance?
Well, it has to be said as a sort of preface that England nearly went down that road, that apparently if the then Home Secretary, now Prime Minister, had her way, the children of illegal immigrants would, as I think it was put, have gone to the back of the queue for primary school places, and therefore not got any sort of, or at least that they would have been in the least desirable schools. Mm. And I can understand that if you're a parent and you see that there's a lot of demand for particular schools and your child doesn't get into that school, and maybe the child of somebody who actually shouldn't be in the country is there, then you wouldn't feel very happy about it. And I would imagine that it would be quite a popular policy in France. But of course, it stands against absolutely everything that you would describe as sort of humanitarian and on the treatment development of children, because the children are deemed, you know, often the children are there legally. If they've been born in the country, their parents may be illegal, but they may have legal status. So it's like visiting the sins of the parents on the children. And I think most civilized and developed countries think that that's a very bad idea.
James, an interesting point that Mary makes about Theresa May's proposal as Home Secretary, which does seem, well, very strikingly similar, we should say. Do you think Theresa May will find it particularly uncomfortable to hear this sort of rhetoric then from Marine Le Pen, of all people, particularly given the ongoing to and fro between the UK and Europe at the moment?
Yes, I mean, it would be interesting to see how she would respond were that proposal put to her, particularly as Nigel Farage, the leader of the UK Independence Party, has on more than one occasion sought to distance himself from Ms Le Pen for what he described as the anti-Semitic nature of her party. So it would be interesting that Mrs May and Ms Le Pen are now apparently finding an alliance somewhere to the right of Nigel Farage in some senses. I mean, I think there's the bigger question. I think the issues that Mary raises about, you know, the view of parents, particularly, you know, in big cities in the UK where school places are at a premium. There aren't enough primary school places here in London, for example. There's a constant shortage of that, is a very valid point. But I think if one thinks longer term, if one wants to try to accommodate and to integrate migrant populations, then of course people have to have an education. In this world, in the modern world, more than any other, education is an absolute key to gainful employment and to understanding and to cultural understanding and all sorts of things. That said, I'm quite sure that Marine Le Pen knows what she's doing in terms of appealing to her proposed constituency for next year's election.
Indeed, and well, perhaps I'll stop short of getting any early 2017 predictions about the likelihood of success for Marine Le Pen. Looks like she'll probably get to the runoff, but let's hope it ends there. Let's cross, though, to neighbouring Germany. Angela Merkel has endorsed a ban on burqas, saying the wearing of full-faced veils should be prohibited in the country wherever it's legally possible, which is interesting detail in there. Mary, what do you make of this? Is this somebody, again, who's trying to say what they think the public would want them to say? Is this a question of, on a point of fact and legal order about identification of people? What do you think prompted Merkel to come out with the remark, which I think took a lot of people by surprise?
I think because it was seen as, in a way, the first chink in Angela Merkel's very high-principled policy of saying that, you know, Germany welcomes refugees, we can manage it, we can integrate people. And I think maybe she's found the going rather tougher than she expected. And especially she's going through a series of meetings and conferences in preparation for her election next year. She says she's standing again. And so this looks to me very much like a little gesture in the direction of her critics. But I think there are two interesting aspects to this. One of them is the qualification that you raised as, you know, wherever it's legally possible, because I think it won't be as in certain places in France and Belgium, where it's all public places where you can ban the full face veil. I think it will simply be things like government institutions, airports, I think hospitals were mentioned, places where, you know, exposing your face is sort of necessary for security and social reasons. So I think that's the that's one of the qualifications. The other is a sort of interesting sideline that I think was brought up when it was first announced, which was that actually there are very few people in Germany who wear a full face veil. Far fewer, in fact, than, say, France or Belgium or possibly the UK, because the vast majority of Muslims in Germany, at least to date, have been Turks, and they generally don't cover their faces.
So it does seem, it seems like a sop to maybe a particular part of the demographic. James, on this broader point about Merkel, you know, perhaps we're wrong to do this, but there's still a temptation to look to Merkel because of her pronouncement since the refugee crisis began, and just generally because she seems to be, you know, a rock of stability in a very uncertain political climate. As Germany, not just, you know, it was always the economic hub of Europe, the driving force, the biggest economy, but also now as something of a bastion of the kinds of liberal values that many of us would like to think the European project was built upon. Are we wrong to do that? And is it a burden that maybe is weighing too heavy on Merkel and maybe even too heavy on the CDU in Germany?
I think and probably Mrs. Merkel finds herself in the situation of having to be an international figure and a domestic politician who has to run for election. I mean, you talking about her liberal image, one thinks of her message of congratulation, if one can describe it as such, when President Trump was elected, talking about how she looked forward to cooperating with him in respecting equality, clearly a dig at some of the more illiberal phrases that he and his supporters had used during the election campaign. Yet, nevertheless, and Mary referred to a chink in Angela Merkel's armour, and clearly in domestic political terms, that has been her refugee policy, and those people have been critical of it, and the undesirable consequences which her critics see as having flowed from that. And this is an attempt to address that, I think, in order to win a domestic election.
Mary, before we move on, just very briefly, I sense from what you said that you were still, if not sceptical, maybe doubtful about Merkel running. She's sort of said that she will.
I think she absolutely will. I think she's not one of the people who would sort of throw out a suggestion and then not do it. I think she absolutely will. But I think that there... It's hard to say that she's got a chance of losing, because the thing is that, you know, being on the centre-right, the opposition is going to be to the left of her. And so she's probably guaranteed at least a new coalition of some sort. Mm-hmm. But the problem is how much the opposition takes away. And if, as in Britain, for instance, the left of centre and the further left starts to be attracted by the policies of the extreme right, and you start getting an alliance which maybe could threaten a new coalition.
Let's conclude our, well, little mini European tour looking at the UK's Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson. His latest remarks: he accused Saudi Arabia of abusing Islam and acting as a puppeteer in proxy wars throughout the Middle East. Now, I wondered whether this is part, James, of some sort of weird 2016 post-truth narrative where all the conventions, all the old alliances are, well, simply forgotten about. So, you know, Boris's remarks on the UK and Saudi Arabia are similar to Trump's behaviour with the US and Taiwan vis-a-vis China. Is that what we're in? Is this the post-truth landscape?
Well, you mentioned 2016. I think if this had happened in any other year, it would have been even more astonishing than probably it is, when you have the Foreign Secretary making this announcement and then the Prime Minister's office immediately saying that's not government policy. How on earth can it not
be
government policy?
I can never recall an example like that in all my years.
And I think the only conclusion that one can draw is that Boris Johnson was speaking out of turn at this meeting.
Surely not, James.
Well, at this meeting, he also, you know, let slip his sort of private briefing paper, which, you know, showed that he hadn't really gone to the conference to discuss any of the substantive issues, if I may paraphrase it, and then is immediately slapped down by the Prime Minister's office. I mean, over the, you know, ever since there was a Foreign Secretary, there's been a discussion as to where the real influence in foreign policy lies. Does it lie with the Prime Minister and his or her office? Does it lie with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office here in London? But in this case, when the such stark contradictions, one really wonders how long this relationship can last.
Mary, is this exactly what everyone, if not thought, feared when Boris got this job?
Well, it is what everybody thought and what everybody feared. But of course, you know, I would say, and there's probably a large constituency of British opinion that would say the same, that actually he's right. What is wrong is British policy. And if he is, as it were, speaking the truth, now is British policy to say one thing and to think one thing and to say and do something else for public consumption? Or are we looking at a real breach between the Foreign Secretary and the Prime Minister? And if we are, how long is Boris in that job?
Well, that's a bigger question for another day, I think. Let's look at Montenegro now. The small Balkan nation has a bid to become the 29th member of NATO, a move that's backed by the White House and the Pentagon, but somehow still unresolved in the Senate. James, why this is a classic. Why would this be held up? Is there a bit of political, I don't know, almost paralysis in the US? What do you think is behind it?
Well, possibly, I think probably that, yes. I mean, I think obviously NATO enlargement has been the single issue which has divided the United States and Russia since the end of the Cold War. And Mary, I'm quite sure, like me, who's observed Russia for many years, would have a view on this too. But it seems to me, without question, if you were to try to ask the Russian diplomatic establishment or ordinary Russians, what is the thing which has annoyed them most about the West since the end of the Cold War? It was the fact that not only did NATO continue to exist, which I think some of them hoped it would disband, but the fact that it expanded to take in former countries, not only from the former socialist bloc, but actually from the former Soviet Union. And so anything to do with NATO enlargement is controversial. And therefore, I think, you know, we find ourselves in a sort of interregnum of US foreign policy as the Obama administration prepares to leave office. And the Trump administration, which, as we've been saying, is clearly not going to seek a direct or early confrontation with Russia, about to take office itself next month.
Mary, on that point about Trump, I mean, presumably he could turn all sorts of foreign policy principles or ambitions on their head. Should we expect no real movement on this then until we learn what his administration looks like into 2017?
Well, I think possibly that may be the case. I mean, I'm slightly surprised, because although there is a very firm convention that sort of nothing is done in the transition, that sort of commits the new president to a particular policy that he might not be committed to otherwise, Montenegro joining NATO perversely really was one of the few things that had met very little objection from the Russians. Montenegro was almost, it was sort of the lowest common denominator. It was the least offensive country to join NATO, both by virtue of its geographical position and its capability. And so it allowed NATO to show that it was intent on continuing to expand. At the same time, it allowed it to say to Russia, look, we're really doing absolutely the least we would do to fulfil that policy. So there were no objections from the Russians. So there was really no need to put it on ice, other than perhaps the thought that Donald Trump is going to have a rather different attitude to NATO.
Indeed. James, a lot of people talk about NATO more broadly and say, look, this is an organisation which fundamentally doesn't quite know what its place in the world is, and the current sort of narrative in terms of Russo-American relations doesn't help. Is it suffering briefly from an identity crisis or an existential crisis even?
I don't think so really. I mean, I think obviously NATO's had a few setbacks. If we were having this conversation 10 or 12 years ago, we would have been discussing the fact that Ukraine and Georgia were probably likely to join in the next few years. And obviously the events of the latter part of the last decade and the early part of this one have put pay to that, and it's quite difficult to foresee that either of those countries will join anytime soon. But I think, you know, NATO has had to have another look at what it's capable of doing. And, of course, a lot of the rhetoric which has come out of NATO is strikingly reminiscent of the Cold War and its approach to Russia, even if, you know, most observers would agree there are substantial differences between the world now and the world during the Cold War. It's a lot less stable, for example, for one. But I think, I think NATO is still trying to realign its ideas in Europe post that sort of that proxy confrontation, if you like, of the last 8 or 10 years or so.
Well, you mentioned Ukraine and Georgia, and I did want to move on to that just before the end of the programme. Citizens from those two countries are now able to visit the EU without a visa, after diplomats and lawmakers struck a deal today to end a bit of a wrangle. Mary, what do you make about this? We spoke about Ukrainian visa-free movement a few weeks ago, and apparently it was all because of the Eurovision Song Contest taking place in Kiev. I don't know if that's a factor. What do you make of this, though? I mean, is this a good news story?
Well, I think from their perspective, it's a good news story, but in a very limited way, because I think there'll be their passports will obviously be checked. They won't be part of the European Union. There will be some concern about people maybe overstaying visas, wanting to get jobs, which will obviously be completely out of the question. And yet that is possibly one of the things that both Georgians, but especially actually Ukrainians would like to be able to do. But I think in terms of face saving, and there's a lot of about sort of face saving and reputation and national image here, that the Ukrainians felt particularly that they'd got a bad deal. They'd opened the country to visa-free travel from the EU. They'd done it the first time they hosted the Eurovision Song Contest, and we hadn't delivered. So I think at least to say that, even if it's not completely honoured, they will feel a degree of vindication. It leaves things looking a little bit better at the end of the year than it did at the beginning.
There we go. What turns out to be the last word to Mary Dujewski. Mary, thanks very much. James Rogers too, thanks for being with us. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. The show was produced by Colotto Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Helena Giri. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next. 1900, The Urbanist is coming your way. More on the big news stories of the day on the Monocle Daily at 2200. This is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you for listening.